And welcome, everybody. This is BNP Weekly, episode 104. And this time we are, unfortunately, at least for this section, we are without Waldeck. But before we go there and clarify who we have here on the call, let's talk about what is BNP Weekly. So BNP Weekly is our weekly show where we talk about what is the latest on Microsoft 365. We go, typically we have a visitor, and then we go through different articles and updates from the Microsoft. And this week, we do have a visitor. And again, I'm forgetting about this intro. My name is Esa Juvonen. I'm a program manager in the OneDrive SharePoint engineering team. And typically, Waldeck would be here, Waldeck Mastercard, who's a cloud advocate, but he has some family things to run unexpected morning this morning. And we'll hopefully get him on the later section when we record that later today. But anyway, we do have a visitor, We do have a visitor in the BNP Weekly, who's Cameron Trier. So Cameron, will you do a quick intro? Who are you?
Awesome. Thanks, Vesa. Great to be able to join you. Yes, my name's Cameron Dwyer. I am based in Sydney, Australia. I am the Chief Technology Officer at an ISV in the Microsoft 365 ecosystem called OnePlace Solutions. And we've been around for well over a decade, sort of rode the wave of the SharePoint ecosystem in the day when it first came out. Yep. Sort of been a regular at the Microsoft conferences, the annual Microsoft conferences, and yeah, sort of been along for the ride with the technology and still going strong, building products and trying to help out.
Yeah, and you're an MVP in the Office Dev category, unless I'm mistaken.
Correct.
Or in the Office App Services, I don't know, because it's weird. Some people are in the other one.
I got my first award just when it turned into Office Development. So it's been Office Development the whole time.
And you're actually, your company is having the kind of a typical, let's say, the growth model where everybody started in SharePoint at some point because SharePoint was so super successful in on-premises. And then we started moving to the cloud. And then most of the companies, well, not most of the companies, but then everybody is gradually adapting all of the other technologies as well, because obviously M365 is not just about SharePoint, even though that has a big role there as well. But can you talk about the let's say, the path to the cloud? So did you do on-premises before, and how does that work?
Yeah, sure. So we started with 2007 had just come out. So let's say prior to that, my background is development through and through. I was a consultant for many, many years. And actually, when I joined this company, we were just a bunch of consultants. And we do custom development work all the way through from requirements gathering to deployment training. We started to transition the company and started to build our own products. Our first products were actually in IBM, Lotus Notes. And around that same time, so we're doing consulting, trying to get some of our own products off the ground. And that was the time that sort of SharePoint hit the market. And it was the first time that we could sort of see that we could deliver the same sort of information worker collaboration solutions on a Microsoft platform as what we could on an IBM platform. Yep. And our customers were starting to transition as well. So it was really solving the same business problems that, and just applying that knowledge to a different technology stack. And so back in those days, there was no cloud. It was all on-premises SharePoint servers. And as I say, we were doing the consulting with SharePoint 2003, but it was really our product started with SharePoint 2007. And our products were all sort of integration products because at that point in time, people were used to thick applications on a desktop. So you install some thick application. Usually there was some heavy server backend as well, but the client was quite rich and everything happened on a desktop and users had the feeling that they were in control. And SharePoint came along and it was very browser-based and there was this big disconnect between a user doing their work on their PC and then having to do this extra step of sort of do things in a browser to get files up there and get files back down. So that's really where we started out is people just weren't getting, and ourselves, because we were doing consulting as well in those days, the biggest user adoption problems that we saw was people just weren't using SharePoint. It was too hard to get files up into it. And then when the files were up in there, they would feel like they lost control. So it was all about integrating and bringing that SharePoint experience down onto the desktop and into the tools that they work with. So we were doing heavy integration in with the Office suite. So Outlook, Excel, Word, PowerPoint, and the Windows file system itself. And so all that was, you know, sort of talking to the SharePoint servers. And that was back in the day, front page server extensions and web services. So it's got the story's got a lot nicer for sure as we've gone along. But we sort of rode that wave and we supported every version of Office and every version of SharePoint. as we made our way towards the cloud, and then BPOS came out and we started integrating with the first sort of SharePoint in the cloud.
Just to clarify, BPOS is the cloud before Office 365. Just for those who are not familiar with that.
then we got the cloud proper. And things got a little bit easier. For us, it was just a multitude, a huge matrix of things to need to support different clients integrating with different server backends. But our software, and still today, we're writing this path between installed client software, which for integrating in with the Office desktop clients, we're developing what are called VSTO add-ins, Visual Studio Tools for Office add-ins. I can talk to you a bit about those a bit later on, but for now, they're our traditional products, and we still take those forward, and they're very rich applications. But at the same time, the development models were evolving and changing. So we're also now sort of reinventing those products under the more modern technology stack. And so we've been sort of transitioning those, and that's been going, that's probably been 4 or more years. Because as soon as the new development models came out, we were testing them, and it was just a matter of finding out, when is the right time? When is this commercially viable that we can deliver enough business value that someone is going to want to buy this? And it's also, when you're going on the bleeding edge of things, there's a huge cost to trying to develop something that can scale and be commercially viable.
And there's not necessarily documentation and guidance up to date on the bleeding edge technology. Somebody chose that in Ignite, and hey, we want to have that. And so is it working or not? That's always the better problem. So
that was sort of the transition. So the transition to the cloud was sort of twofold, in that our desktop software, our traditional desktop installed software, we were still integrating with SharePoint in the cloud. And so organizations were starting their journey into the cloud, and we were supporting that, and still are today, with these VSTO installed client solutions. And then the second shift for us was really moving our own software into the cloud and running it as a true SaaS offering. Rather than people having to download our software and install it on PCs, it's now available through a marketplace. There is no software to install. It's available on mobile devices. And there our deployment model changes radically. Rather than having to go through sort of IT deployment every 6 months or so in some of these larger organizations, we're to a point where for our modern applications, we release every Tuesday.
Yeah. And then you update that, basically they update the SaaS service, and then it's updated to all of the customers because of the subscription model which you have, right?
So exactly.
Now before we go actually there, and let's obviously concentrate today on the partner opportunities and the models how work, but let's go back in time for the moment where you decided that you actually want to do products. Why products, why not consulting? What was that decision point?
Probably based, I'd say twofold. One, based financially, having done consultancy for, at that point, would have been over a decade of doing consulting, we realized that there's a cap on how much we can earn. You're basically selling your time. You can package up and reuse, bits of technology and techniques that you've got and repackage them up and sort of make a profit off those. But really, you can just extrapolate your time out, and there's a cap on how much you can make out of this. Going to product sort of removes that cap, if you like. There was a point in time where the people I was working with were all of a similar age. We're all starting to have children, have a family. And the consulting life, you're really at the mercy a little bit of the organizations that you're working for. At that time, we were going out on site still. It was very much a you go out to a client type world that we're living in. They could be long days, and you didn't have sort of that ultimate control. We shift that into a product company. While you've got a lot of demands of you, you also have a lot more control over your time. So it was a bit of a lifestyle choice as well. And what we saw when we moved from the IBM world to the SharePoint world is we actually found that the consulting world, the amount of effort that you needed to put in to get stuff working and keep stuff working, because it was evolving quite quickly, is that there was there was more longevity in spending that time doing product than there was doing the consulting. There was a lot to to get your head around. Yeah.
That's actually a good point on also the fact that you need to keep, if you do a customer, let's say, as a system integrator deployments for customer, then keeping all of that stuff up to date and making sure that customer, whatever specific solution is up to date, is actually quite a lot of work. And then as a developer, that might feel bad to leave the customers behind, knowing that their stuff will, let's say, go old in a year or two. So rather than having a SaaS service, which is all the time up to date, and you can basically offer services, that's actually an interesting perspective as well. But now, coming back on that, so you said you basically have two different transitions in the company. One was the one that you started doing cloud, and first you were probably then doing the customer-specific deployments, right? And then you moved into the SaaS service. Why as a SaaS service? Then you're transforming to be a real ISV.
That's true. So there's many transitions that we've gone through. Each one of those is a pretty massive hurdle. When you talk about going to SaaS, there's multiple things. There's, from a technology point of view, moving your stuff and actually running it as a service where it's hosted and people coming into you. But also from a billing perspective, when we first started doing the SaaS, we weren't set up to be billing under a SaaS model with subscriptions. It was very much still you're buying a perpetual license and you're buying support and maintenance, even though we were running the thing as a SaaS. So we've actually flipped that on its head now, and all of our revenue is SaaS. So even our customers that have got the installed software, they're still buying it on a subscription. So we've moved the billing to be like a SaaS organization would run, and also move the software across from a SaaS hosting perspective as well. But they were two separate transitions for us.
Yeah. How hard was the transition? Because obviously, I think there's a lot of other partners who are looking potentially doing the subscription model as well. And then that requires, like you said, technical work, and then it requires process work and all of that stuff. How long did it take, or how hard was it?
Look, I don't think it was something where we focused on doing it as a project as quick as we could. So it probably took a lot longer than what others could do it, the length of time others could do it in. But what we found was, what we tried to do, and what we try to do in a lot of our business, is not invent, create, engineer our own solutions to things. So we went out and looked, and this is probably what took the longest period of time, is actually looking for any platforms that we could use to do our subscription management with. That we could plug into. And we looked at it multiple times, and it took so long because at the end of it, we thought, no, there's got to be an answer here. There has to be some platforms out there that actually do this. There's a lot of companies now offering software as a service. How on earth are they doing the billing? And what we found was that, the penny dropped to me after the first round or two of looking, is that there's a difference between subscription management and license management. So, there is, and there definitely is when you're talking about doing a B2B offering where an organization might be buying 10,000 licenses. So what there was a lot of subscription platforms out there that were doing B2C, where it's a one-to-one relationship. A customer can come online, sign up for something, and they're just buying one user license of something, and the management sort of aspect of it's not needed under that scenario. But when you're talking about selling a piece of software that's got 100, 1,000, 10,000 user licenses, then it's a bit of a different model. So the subscription engines that are out there, and this is what we use a subscription engine, we can build our own. So it takes care of signing up an organization, and you load in your products into that subscription platform, and it takes care of the renewals and sort of tracking your churn and that sort of information. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't know if your subscription is based on users. It doesn't really know what to do with that information. All it can do is give you, your development team, the answer to that question. If your software wants to know, is this user licensed, it can't tell you that. All it can tell you is that this organization has a subscription for this many users or for this threshold of throughput. So it's really just the definition of the subscription. And then it's really up to you to implement the licensing. Well, it was for us. We couldn't find something that would give us both. So we kind of had to do the user management. So our software works on a user basis. So we have to identify the users that are coming in, track them to what subscription that they're on, and do our own sort of users to subscription management.
Mapping. Okay. But technically what you're saying is that you have a third party service which you use for the money and subscription handling and all of that stuff. So you don't have to worry about that.
Correct.
Which is actually quite smart because, again, offloading the thing which is not core for your business, because I don't think customers are looking into buying your service because of the subscription model. They're buying because of the other reason. So and that's been working out for you then really well.
It has. It has its problems and wrinkles, and I'm not 100%.
Like everything.
And I should point out as well that the Microsoft Store through AppSource, so we list our software through AppSource, and that's where people can acquire the software from.
Yeah.
And you can look at the store from two different I see it as providing two things fundamentally. One is a deployment model to get your software in the hands of users, and that's what we use it for. But the other is you can actually use that as your subscription engine if it works for you. So people can buy and subscribe to it, your software through that storefront as well. And then you integrate in with that, and that sort of tells you the same information. It can tell you this organization has bought this subscription. It's got this many users. When we went through the transition, the store just didn't have that in place. And it's just recently gone through another overhaul with some more APIs that are available. So it would definitely be worth looking at, especially if it's a vendor inside of the M365
ecosystem. Yeah.
Now,
that's actually really interesting and also a good direction and guidance for others who are looking into how to make things happen. What about then the transition to the, let's say, Microsoft 365 in general? How do you see the opportunity? I'm putting you on the spot. How would you define the opportunity for partner ecosystem in Microsoft 365? And I get that we as a Microsoft should be doing a good job of explaining that. But what's your perspective on the opportunity?
Look, I think you sort of said it at the start of this conversation. There's a lot of the people that are in the community came from a SharePoint background. And to explain the opportunity, there's a massive opportunity just in SharePoint or just in that office where we sort of see the core of the people. But when you think of all the products that have expanded beyond that, I don't know if I can give you an answer as to where all the opportunity is because it's so big now. Yeah. There's telephony companies coming in that they've got a huge opportunity. And it's probably something we don't traditionally think about. But for me, looking at that traditional user base that we've had is the opportunity is really that Microsoft is doing extremely well as a cloud provider, as providing business tools on top of a cloud. And doing it in a way that enterprise is adopting it. I mean, it's one thing to get consumers on board and get small seats, but when you've got major companies having the trust in Microsoft to put their data on the platform, then that's a really, really good indication that, you know, this is going to have longevity and you're going to have the customers on board to support your endeavors in that area as well. But the opportunity for us is, it's very much end user collaboration tools, information workers. And for that, the Office Suite has been for decades now, it's sort of the number one content creation and consumption suite on the planet. The ability for us to write add-ins and by building add-ins inside of the Office Suite, we're really keeping the users in context of what they're doing. We're bringing the tools and the different parts of the ecosystem to them when they need it. So for us, being able to actually surface our functionality inside of a suite that is already so popular and got so many millions of users.
Millions of users, yes.
Super compelling, super compelling. Yeah. If you were to try and create your own standalone application, how long is it going to be before you can reach a user base like that? That is the number one most compelling reason for, I think, people trying to get a foothold into this ecosystem.
Yeah. And of course, if we think about this from a Microsoft perspective, we've been going through this in the phases as well with customers. So one of the big thing was that whenever we get the customers, their Azure AD in place, then their identity is in a cloud, because that's been that at some point that was really, really the problem was that, hey, we need to get the first Azure AD to install. And then the next big thing was obviously files. And your company is then taking advantage of the files and documents which are in the cloud so that nobody it has to store anything in the on-premises anymore. And then you can access all of that stuff using whatever device, so which is pretty cool. But yeah, I'm just thinking in the phases as well. What's if you think about your company journey, or if you think about the readiness of the platform, and you can be fully transparent and blunt on these things, and what are the challenges related on Microsoft 365? So where would Microsoft need to do better? It's not probably all just shiny and perfect, and there are areas to improve as well.
Like as you said, identity is the key, really, to being able to deliver all of this. And we saw that once different workloads inside of Microsoft all came onto one unified identity sort of, and you could identify the user across all the different workloads, that's when Microsoft started to do the integrations themselves. And that's where the speed really started to pick up on seeing functionality, like cross-cutting concerns across products and being able to deliver really good integrations. And having that same identity flow through into third-party products and being able to identify users and then call back into the Microsoft 365 data and leverage it, that's where the real power is. But fundamental to that is being able to authenticate users. And as I go through, and I see it internally with my own company, but as part of the MVP work that I do, you know, I go out and I do the developer boot camps and help out here, there, and everywhere. But what I see time and time again is authentication and identity just being that barrier for developers getting in. Often the training material and stuff will gloss over that or will take a shortcut way of getting you past the auth because we know it's going to be such a difficult topic that people get stuck on. And it's also doing it properly is I wouldn't say difficult or challenging. It's almost something that I, as a developer, I'm not a security expert in the way that I would want to be to feel confident to write my own. The libraries are getting better. The MSAL libraries are getting better. But there for a long time, you would cut and paste snippets that Microsoft gave you and you would follow the instructions to put it all in place. But that's not a library that gets taken forward when security vulnerabilities are found, because that when you copy and paste it, that's now yours. You've got to take care of that and water it. It's not a proper library thing. Thankfully, the MSAL libraries have come along and a lot of that has been replaced by standard libraries that we can call. For the longest time, we had a big issue, and a lot of our but the UI pieces of it we've still written ourselves because we're an Office add-in. A lot of the MSAL prompting didn't work for us because of the way Office add-ins are hosted inside of the Office products themselves. They're sandboxed iframes. You can't pop up dialogue. So the MSAL libraries sort of aren't designed to work inside of that sort of container and framework. So that story's evolving. It's coming along. Single sign-on is coming along as well. But some of that probably won't solve our problems either. And that's actually an interesting one. Let's dive in on that quickly. So something like single sign-on is, as a product company, there's two things, and they sort of come from different sides. Let's take single sign-on. To get single sign-on to work, something has to be trusted by your organization and consented to for the security to flow through. So you've kind of at a point where, from an ISV's perspective, in order to get an organization to try your product, or to get it just in front of one user, you've sort of kind of bottlenecked on someone giving security permissions to your application. They want to know all about your application, have trust in your application before they approve it. So that sort of rules out the single sign-on for just trialing things, which is from an ISV, because often you think of an ISV as, oh, they're a product company. Yes, they'll be able to get that SSO stuff, and that's not a problem. But it really doesn't work like that. The way that it works is that people just want to kick the tires. One person in an organization, and it's typically the business user that's got the use case, they will want to just try your product out. They'll just want to download it. They just want to use it for themselves and just see if it's going to fix their problem before they bother anyone else in the organization. So actually being able to just download something from the store, get in there with minimum permissions, and for them to try it out before they build their business case to go to IT to try to get those approvals. So in a way where I say this identity, there's many things being at play in the identity, but I don't think single sign-on is going to solve that across the board. And it's the same issue with kind of Teams and SharePoint as well.
Yeah. So on that one, actually, just out of curiosity, how we should be solving that? Should we have a basic set of permissions, which we always provide for the end users so that people can actually do things? Because right now, I think the biggest problem that we keep on having is that we don't want to grant default permissions for any application. And that's really then causing the problem that, well, you need to be an administrator to grant certain level of permissions or all of that. Maybe in other platforms, they actually grant basic set of permissions and it is more flexible than to just install that and start using it. What's your thinking on that?
That's good. I don't know what the end solution is to that. for us, from a developer's point of view on the way the ecosystem is at the moment, to me, I just think, well, SSO is great, but it's not the answer for trialing. So for us, we just don't go through SSO. It just means we have to handle the identity ourselves. Other things that I've sort of thought of over time were doing time-based consent. So, you know, someone trials something for a day, a week, a month, but only give the consent for that period of time. Because a lot of what happens is once consent's given, that the sort of the horse is bolted and we're never going to get that back. So it is a tough one. And actually, this is probably something that we didn't hit until we started moving into cloud and modern authentication, is just the whole issue of trust and security. This, I've never spent as much time as I have in the last 2 years talking trust and security with organizations.
Because of the massive permission requests which the application require, or
it's not the massive, it's weird. I think it's just a shift in the way that we've always done things. So if you wanted to do a modern application today, then your consent is going to go through Azure Active Directory and you're asking for granular permissions. Now, people are used to this because on their mobile phone, something will ask to use your camera, it'll ask for your contacts details. And this sort of granular permission is what we see through Azure Active Directory asking for your data that's stored inside of Microsoft 365. And it's kind of, from an organization's point of view, it's never been clearer because the applications have to spell out at a very granular level what they want access to. And we sort of go out of our way to document, well, why do we need that and what are we going to do with that data? And these are the conversations I typically have. Interestingly, for our desktop applications, which get installed on a PC, there is no granular security.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, because you are already in the Windows authentication, and then you can just use the Windows identity any way you want.
Every file, everything.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's so much what people are asking for. I think it's just a change in the way that we've always done things.
Yeah.
Under the new model, people get presented with a dialogue. The dialogue looks scary. It's when people don't understand things, it becomes scary, they shut down, and it creates a barrier. And I think we're just moving through this phase of this becoming the new normal, people actually understanding what this means, understanding what the risk is and what they're exposed to. In reality, the risk is actually a lot less than what it used to be. It doesn't seem like that from what people are being presented with. And from an ISV perspective as well, the lag between Microsoft being successful with cloud computing and the ISV partner community being successful with cloud computing is different. Yep. Microsoft's are very large. They've got a lot of certifications behind them. And Microsoft has rightly earned the trust of the large organizations, the protection of their data and the handling practices of that data. But that trust doesn't flow through to the ISV community, nor should it, because there can be bad actors out there. So for those that are getting into the ecosystem, you really do need to have a focus on your security, on your data handling, and on your trust. And if you go in with a mindset of we'll just cut corners on those things, I don't think you'll be successful and you'll find a lot of barriers in your way.
Yeah. Makes sense. Now, identity is one thing where we need to, obviously we we're on this journey of making it easier. We're increasing the abstraction so that it will be super, super easier for the developers to take advantage of that, because identity is something, like you said, it should just work and kind of a plug and play to your solution. In your case, just recapping or paraphrasing, you actually have a separate identity sign-in in your solution, right? So whenever you're exposing the solution, you ask them to sign in, and then that's going to be the identity model.
Sure.
What else? What else? What's the other areas where we should be improving? We can talk about, for example, Microsoft Graph is a absolutely brilliant platform for accessing information. And I think everybody knows that we need to do further investments on the Microsoft Graph API surface. I think that's heading to the right direction for sure. So a lot of stuff across the different services, make it super easy to access the information. Any specifics on that side of the house?
Yeah, look, Microsoft Graph has been great. I would love to get to the point where that's the only API we need to integrate.
Yeah, of course.
It would be amazing. But there's a long history, and we do a lot of integration with SharePoint. It's probably one of the largest existing APIs that's out there. And that takes time to move across, and we understand that. But the graph, the idea, the concept that you can just do authenticate once to the graph and get access to all the workloads, the fact that you can just do one set of error handling, just train your developers on one API is just amazing. Probably one of the things that isn't immediately obvious when you go to the graph is how discoverable it makes things from a development perspective. Because let's say you, like, take our solution. We need to get users' details, which would be historically in AAD. We integrate with Mail and Calendar, which would be in Exchange. We hit files in SharePoint and OneDrive. And we do integration with Teams as well. Now, if these were all separate APIs and separate products, we'd have to deal with auth and everything. But the big thing is, how do you know where those servers are? Like, if this was on-premises, how would we know where their Exchange server is? How would we know what the name of their AAD is? How would we know what the name of their SharePoint server is? And so what this led to in the past, and you still see it a lot today, is that you start up a piece of software and the first thing it asks for you is to put in the name of your server or a URL or there are these technical things that business users don't have the answers to. When you move across to the graph, all you need to do, because everything's graph.microsoft.com, is your API, it doesn't change. All you've got to ask the user for is to log in. They know what their email address is, because you're not asking them for new credentials, you're asking them to log in as their Microsoft identity. So they know their username, they know their password. Once you get there, you can discover where everything else is. And so from an onboarding perspective, from a first use perspective of someone using your software, is incredibly smooth compared to what it used to be, because there used to be so many technical questions you needed to ask.
Absolutely. That certainly is one of the key benefits of the graph. And we are investing on the graph surface across the board. But like I said, one of the good examples is being the good old, some people call it legacy, some people call it the most widely used API, which is the SharePoint, because the SharePoint API is just massive in CSAM and REST APIs. And then getting all of that moved to the graph is surprisingly painful, but we're on a journey on that. So we'll get there eventually. So one step at a time. Do you actually see it as a massive thing to fall back between the graph and then REST and CSAM if needed? Or you can always do the refresh access tokens from Azure AD and get access on things. So, but you still need to know the API. So,
yeah, that's right. I mean, there's still a lot. We flip between them. We use CSOM, we use SharePoint REST, we use Graph.
Yeah.
So we try to be Graph first, but you need to be able to do a unit of functionality. Like when you're building out the features of your application, you know, you click on a button and then a chain of things happens in your application. You know, you trigger something, a chain of things needs to happen. You need to be able to do that whole chain of things usually with one API, because if you can't, and you sort of get halfway through and then you go and switch to another API, switch to another one, the performance isn't great. And what you might find is that, well, why call the graph when I've got to fall back to CSOM and the actual calls I can make, I can actually make one call across the wire to do it all. So that's kind of what we found inside of our products, is some areas of it we can use the graph and we do. Other areas of it we've sort of rolled back to CSOM or REST. So, yeah, there's it's... it's certainly coming along, and the more stuff that hits the graph and that mentality of graph first within Microsoft, the more that mentality actually resonates through the APIs, the smoother it's going to be to get developers onto it, especially us from a it probably happens more from an ISV perspective than it does from an enterprise dev perspective, in that if something, let's say you take a SharePoint API, if Microsoft launches a new feature, here's an example of one, the lists, old, but there was some new APIs around lists, so my recent lists, my favorite lists, things like that. That hit the SharePoint API first, which from an engineering perspective, you can understand why. It hasn't played through to the graph yet. But from a ISV perspective, you're kind of forced to use the API where the functionality comes out in first. Because if we don't, our competitors will.
Yeah, and that API isn't necessarily even documented, right? If we are being fully transparent on this challenge, so
So from a, there's probably more pressure on ISVs because it's a competitive landscape that we have to use the first API that functionality hits. So if it's not hitting the graph, then the ISVs can't go graph first. That's just the rules of engagement.
And then the documentation means that it's actually officially supported, but customers don't really understand that. They just want to have the feature and capability. And like I said, if you don't actually provide that as an ISV, your competitor will. So it's an interesting challenge. And that's something which we've been actively trying to figure out, how do we do this in the right way? Because obviously, like I said, it makes sense theoretically provide that API first in AA, for example, in the SharePoint case, in a SharePoint REST API, because the first party experience, the ones which Microsoft implements, their primary purpose is to get the functionality out. And then the secondary objective is actually offer that functionality for the partners, unfortunately. And this is something which we need to work on in the future. So really kind of have the, is it craftsmanship of the API? Is it the reusability or have a partner as a first-party experience as well. So providing the API by default for first-party and partner ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But we need to work on that because immediately when you start doing that, it has a larger cost. So that's the decision matrix. So
there's probably a good plug there for PNP libraries as well, in that sometimes that can act as the proxy between those underlying layers. So some of the PNP libraries and the calls will be using SharePoint calls today, but over time, those calls may happen in those libraries, get transferred over to be graph calls. We've seen that happen in the past. So from a developer perspective, if you're on the PNP library, some of this transition from moving to one to using the other might be totally transparent to you, and you need to do no work, which is one great reason to be using those PNP libraries.
And that's obviously from day one, related on PNP libraries. Why did we create them? Well, we saw that there are gaps, and let's not build 27,000 unique libraries across the partner ecosystem. Let's build one together, and then whenever we update things there, everybody will benefit. And it has, though, its own challenges for sure. But the thinking is that whenever something moves across the APIs, it's completely seamless potentially for the partner ecosystem to then to use a more polished API or a more advanced API. Now, moving away from API layer, what about the UX layer? If we think about Office UI Fabric, the SPFX controls, I don't know how much actually you guys are using SPFX, but and then the Fluent UI, Fluent UI controls. So what about and the Craft Toolkit, obviously. You can actually see that we are more and more building controls and reusable elements, which are UX layer thing as well. So what's your, let's say, take on that?
Absolutely love it. It was something I probably was, I think I was asking for, and quite a few years ago. It was when we were starting to redevelop what we'd done in our VSTO add-ins, and we were trying to modernize those and build them under the modern add-ins. Because at that point in time, what our client utilities do, one of the parts that they do is they allow you to edit all the SharePoint metadata and all that prompting, all that columns of information and content types, those taxonomy pickers, all of that sort of stuff. We'd rebuilt all of that client-side to integrate it in with the Office suite. And we're faced with doing that again under web technologies.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to have to go to the pains of doing that all ourselves. In the end, we have, and we've rebuilt all of those components. But look, I love the direction, and I've been doing a little bit. I've been working with the Microsoft Graph Toolkit team there at Microsoft, and outside of Microsoft, there's been other people in the community as well, because I really love the direction that the Graph Toolkit's going in. Because I was familiar with the different Microsoft initiatives on the UX layer. I can talk quickly to the problems, or not necessarily the problems, but how we try to use it. So we knew we needed to build all these controls ourselves. We wanted them to look like Office components if we could. So we knew that you guys had built them for SharePoint. I was like, can we reuse any of these components that are inside the PMP libraries or that are in SharePoint natively? Or like, can we somehow use some of this stuff, how we can now use Power Apps that takes a rendition of the controls? Can we leverage any of that? And after a lot of talking around and probing, that we found that really none of this could work. We tried to hack together different bits and pieces of how SharePoint worked. But fundamentally, those controls would only work if they were sitting on a SharePoint page. You could not take them off the SharePoint page and get them to work. And that's what's now happening, is we're now seeing, and that's what's happening in the Graph Toolkit, is these are components that for the first time are designed to work outside of the SharePoint environment. And that's the key difference there, is you can take them and... because that's where the libraries have gone, and that's where we've lived from day one, is we've communicated with SharePoint without living on the SharePoint server. And if you think about the SharePoint framework development these days, like it's from an API perspective, it's client-side development. You're making calls back to the SharePoint server. But the one shortcut little nicety of that is you're running on the SharePoint page, and that allows some nice trickiness to happen, which the SharePoint framework provides for. Back to the Graph Toolkit. Those components are built onto the top of the Graph API, and they're building whole widgets of functionality that you can use in your own applications. The other thing I love about the Graph Toolkit, which is different to the Fluent libraries, is that the Graph Toolkit is web components, like real legit web components. And what web components are is they are something that any browser, modern browser, can understand. And you can use them inside of any sort of web project, whether it's vanilla HTML, JavaScript, CSS, or jQuery, or if you're using a full-blown framework like Angular or React, you can use those components, which is fantastic. And that's the direction I would have liked to have seen, the Fluent, and back in the day, the Office UI Fabric. That was kind of my feedback. Because in those times, we had to make a call very early on what we were going to use as a framework to develop our web technology off. And we went with Angular. At that point in time, that was kind of the direction that Microsoft was going in as well. It came as a bit of a surprise when the direction changed to React. And it was still, we didn't know which way that would go, because not all decisions sort of pan out for the long term either. So we've built all of our stuff in Angular, and we've steered clear of the Fluent components, because the Office UI Fabric, initially it was JavaScript, so it would work anywhere. And then the more advanced components came out in React, and we sort of stayed on some of the core. And we still use it for the styling, to get the colors, the fonts, the themes. We still leverage all of that from the sort of the core of it. But, yeah, we never used the more elaborate components because we were on Angular, not React. Had that been developed as web components, we would have been able to use them, as would anyone on any technology stack.
Yeah.
And the danger we could see there is what happens when React's not the coolest kid on the block anymore. We'd kind of be stuck with those. Microsoft would have to redevelop the whole thing under new technology, or everyone's stuck on React as the tech world moves on, whereas web components is a much safer bet.
Yeah, it's basically technology agnostic, except the only challenge, what you said, is the modern browser requirement. So IE 11 does not work, which is good because we can finally leave that behind, hopefully.
Yes. Probably the other thing that doesn't hit the radar of a SharePoint developer, but should now for those that are looking to get into Teams development, and certainly does in the Office development, is... from a UI perspective, we are now off on mobile devices on those things, like SharePoint is, but not your traditional sort of SharePoint page customizations that you'd be expecting. But if you're developing like tabs in Teams, Teams extensions, and certainly if you're developing Office add-ins, they run on mobile devices as well. Yep. So like our Outlook add-in works on iOS and Android phone. But when you think of the styling out there, the styling guidelines is don't make it look like Office. It needs to look like a native Android application or a native iOS application. And I'm not sure if that has been addressed in Fluent yet. It certainly wasn't in the Office UI Fabric. So it would mean that if we were to use the Office UI Fabric, we'd be able to use all those controls for like the web access versions of Office and on the desktop. Yeah. And on Mac, it would probably you'd probably get away with it, but you would not. You would have to use something totally different on those other devices. So by building the components ourselves, we're able to get the functionality we need, and it's simply a style sheet change across the different form factors, the different operating environments, and we're able to achieve those design guidelines and hit them.
And that's basically then your company owns IP, so you haven't actually shared any of that stuff openly in the community, because that's a competitor differentiator for you as well.
Yeah, but it works both ways as well. Like as a ISV and an organization, like the power of community is very strong, and we seriously looked at taking the Microsoft libraries, forking them, and using those as our base. But as I say, because the direction at that time wasn't in our technology space, it just didn't make sense. Had that been under web components, then maybe we would have done something differently and been able to build those out. Because there has been a similar, and I know that Ilio Struff has done a lot of work on sort of the property controls pane for web parts and things. A lot of those controls are exactly what we've developed. So there's very similar things that we needed to go through. And it was touch and go. If technology was different,
It really depends on the company situation. It depends on what's available in the community and open source. It's available what Microsoft provides. And then for Office UI Fabric, as an example, there was a more focus on the first party experience than the third party experience. And I know we're now having discussions with Fluent UX team, and they're building their own new components and trying to figure out that they prioritize the third party and partner ecosystem as well. So. Because if they would be web components, like you said, then they will work in the Angular, they will work in React, they will work in any technology, which is great. So, but let's see. So anyway, no definite answers there. Now, we've been chatting almost too long already. I think we need to start closing it. Our target is always 1 hour together with articles. But just putting you on a spot for one last discussion point, which is, if I'm a partner and across the world, wherever, why would I want to have a look on the Microsoft 365 ecosystem? So just recapping the opportunity there. What's in it for me? Why does it matter?
Your addressable audience is massive. And you've already got people that have the software installed. And you're usually adding on to... You're adding on to something that companies have already invested in, and they're already realizing the value of, and that's a much easier proposition to come in on. And I just, as I said, made the comment before that the Microsoft Cloud, and that sort of goes even beyond Microsoft 365 and out into sort of the Azure platform on which a lot of it's built. It's really strong from an enterprise perspective. And being able to scale and confidently build solutions that are targeting everyone from the small sort of mum and dad shops right up to Fortune 500 companies. And that's something that I think if you were to look at other ecosystems and other platforms, I just don't know if I'd have the same level of confidence. Yeah.
That's actually a great closing for this discussion. That was a really good. So thank you, Cameron, on that one. So really great stuff. Now, as Well, so anyway, so thanks to everybody for watching, and thanks everybody for listening. If you're choosing the podcast option, which is available as well, we will be back with a next BNP Weekly within a week. So surprise, surprise. So unless both of us have any blocking things, so hopefully not. So I think we can deal with this. So, and Waldeck will be most likely back within a week as well. But thank you, Cameron. Thank you, everybody who's watching. And we'll be definitely in touch. Bye-bye. Welcome, Waldeck. You missed the discussion with Cameron earlier today due to family reasons, but it's all good. So all good at the family time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like you have your best plans and you want to do things and life happens. So you need to adjust and that's the way things work, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, exactly. I will watch the recording.
Yeah. Yes. That was a good discussion. You missed a lot. No. So like we promised together with Cameron discussion, we're going to do the articles and together with Waldeck. And this is the later part. It is actually quite
it
a few
late.
Hours.
Later. It is late. It's dark outside.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's November, Finland. Ooh, it's dark.
The Netherlands, too. So,
yeah. Anyway, so let's do some articles. They're actually quite silent week on the Microsoft side, which was by design because there was the US election and there was a roles inside of Microsoft that we shouldn't be actually publishing in certain days. We do understandable reasons. Now, let's not concentrate on politics. Let's talk about the articles. So anyway, last week, announcement of general availability of Microsoft to do APIs in Microsoft Graph, a super, super highly weighted capability. And I think this was getting a lot of attention, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, like this was awaited for a long time already, right?
So
now these APIs are generally available, meaning they are available on the V1 endpoint. So they're ready for prime time to use in production.
Woohoo! Yay! Now, the second thing, which you're going to actually talk about as well, CLI for Microsoft 365 V3.2. What do we have here?
So every month we release a new version. This time around, we spend a lot of time refactoring you could call it the engine of CLI. So we move from a package that we use for over almost 2.5 years now to build CLI upon. It got deprecated, out of date. So we remove it, refactor a number of things. Among which, one of the gems that we didn't even include in Nodes is reworking of our help. So in the past, we had help done in two ways. We had a help in command and help in markdown. In markdown being the things that we have on our website where we do more things like highlighting code snippets and so forth and so on. Now we actually brought that into a one experience where we use the markdown data to show that in console. And we did some great work together with
Stefan Espinosa. Yeah,
exactly. Like he built a package named Markshell, and that thing translates Markdown into a format that is rich and yet shown in terminal, which is a really great experience. And on our end, it frees us from having to maintain help twice, once in command and then another one in Markdown, right?
Yeah.
So these are like big things that we addressed in V3.2. Along with, we've added some more script samples, new commands, so we would encourage you to check it out and tell us what you think.
Cool. Really cool stuff. It's good to see that. I think the key, like we said so many times with the open source and community, is consistency. Just keep the train rolling. And it's fine to have a slower month, and it's fine to have a slower week, as long as you keep on train rolling.
Define slow, right? Because if you think about it, like maybe we hit fewer items. But the amount of work, like a refactoring like that,
I wasn't talking about this being a smaller
app.
I'm more concentrating on the consistency.
Yeah.
Just keep on releasing, keep on rolling. This one isn't necessarily a small release. So not taking anything away from it. Now, this one is really cool from Rapia earlier today. We talked about this one with Rapia quite a few times in offline or online. Where is it? Online. So...
I don't know if you have met in person.
No, actually, good point. Maybe I'll just fly over. No, I can't. Never mind. Now, but basically, there's a few different, let me zoom in, a few different, you actually, Waldeck, wrote about the knee experience, which we brainstormed quite technically at some point, which was really cool. And then there's a great story on what, how you implement that one in Microsoft Teams. And then there's a example already how to do that as a SaaS application. But what Rabia is now and showing here is that how do you do it with an SPFX and Microsoft Craft Toolkit. So and really Teams. Cool setup and Teams, and obviously in Teams, yes. So you can really easily build this cool looking UX with few lines of code. So super, super simple. And then you have multiple different tabs, for example, planning and insights, and then settings and configurations for it. So super cool thing. We are already kind of planning and having a high level discussions that maybe we should write a too small tutorial series on this one to kind of setting it up, because it's using React as well, and it's actually so really nice setup overall. I think it's using React. Yes, it is.
So, it is. It does.
Yeah. Of course it is.
It kind of gives it away.
Yeah. Yeah. It said React on the page. You know, it's but you understand that only if you read. Anyway, so but basically really cool setup, and also showing the theming and all of that. So really, really cool stuff. Shawa Mendes getting credits also on that one. Shawa is just absolutely brilliant on the UX implementation in SPFX as well. So really, really cool stuff, and getting shared as an open source solution. Now, this one is from you, Waldeck. What's this is all about?
So this is just a quick piece of code basically showing you like how to get the real image behind either a person or a group in Graph, right? So when you build an application, you might want to show people or groups, and you want to show often the picture of that to make it easier for people to find the right person or a group.
Yep.
I found that there is no end-to-end piece of code showing you like how you exactly do that. And there are quite a few things you have to do, right? So you have to have the response type, you have to get the blob converted to an URL. So there are a few things that you have to get just right. And I found that these things, at least right now, are not explained in the docs, right? So
yeah.
I hope that we will be able to address that soon. But until then, here you have a complete piece of code you can just use in your application and to get that image and show it in your app.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cool stuff. Now, Paul Bullock had a interesting story related to many ways of set UK local, well, technically any local in SharePoint. So, and really talking about the different options and how they change the experience and settings and the language and dates and all of that stuff. So there's quite a few different ways of doing this, and how does it then impact on the OneDrive or in files and in Office and all of that stuff. So really, really good clarification on how things actually work. Now, this one is from Tomomi, Beginner's Guide for Microsoft Teams Development, Messaging Action. So really talking about, it's a series of things, and this is the third one. So how do we build a messaging extension, and how do we take advantage of that one? Are we talking about cats? No, not at this point. Morse code. Yeah, not cats. Where's the cat? No. But good clarification on how to make things happen, and really nice story how does it actually work, what do you need to do, and all of that stuff. Now, this one is from Terry Matula. It's about Microsoft Teams and Graph API, all about scopes and really kind of clarifying what the scopes actually mean. Because again, if you are new on these things, maybe you're not familiar on how the scopes mean and what does it actually mean, and what does it mean from a branding perspective as well. And what are the things, how does it relate on this? So really nice blog post explaining that as well. And obviously, you need to ask more scopes if you need to get access on more items. And it might be actually difficult then figuring out which are the scopes, what I need to do. So
luckily, all of that is explained in the docs.
Yes, yes. Everything is always in docs. Now, this one is from, I want to get the Marcin Wojciechowski. Wojciechowski. Thank you, Waldeck. And really about how do we do mocking of the AI HTTP provider for Microsoft Graph when you're doing SPFX development. So really, really cool stuff as well. So super, super useful for people to take advantage. So really, really cool. Thank you for that one. Then we have two videos. This one is from the Microsoft Power Apps community call, so Power Apps web part. So April and Hugo are explaining this really, 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 really cool Power App embedding web part, which can be adjusted and configured in multiple different ways. So really cool stuff from them. Then we have our Italian friend. So
he's very passionate about a topic, obviously.
Azure AD B2C, yeah?
Yes. Who wouldn't?
That's super important topic. So really cool video as well. So 7 minutes on the topic. And these are really cool videos on catching up on, okay, that's how it works. Okay, fine. Another two long things as well. Pete Skelly had a good blog post related on share SBCAF rules across the project using Azure DevOps multiple repo builds. You might actually know, Waldeck, what is an SBCAF? Can you explain?
Yes. So basically, I used to do this in my previous job. So basically, when you build code, any kind of code on 365, you want to ensure that it's built correctly, that there are as few mistakes as you can have, that you haven't missed anything. And then with that, with SBCAF, that is a product by Rancor that has tons of rules that allows you to check, is your solution up to par? Is there anything you could improve? Are there any risks that you have? And so forth and so on. And here in the article, Pete explains how you can store them centrally and then apply them to many different projects without having to recopy them, reclone them, and so forth and so on.
Yep. So really cool stuff and absolutely a useful set of rules for any development for sure. So really, really cool. And then the last piece is the 5 rules of the field for file server migrations to Microsoft 365. Please go to the cloud, go to the cloud, go to the cloud. But it's basically
go
just...
Cloud, go to the cloud, go to the cloud.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the 5 rules. Yes, indeed. Yes. But yeah, so basically, that's actually good learning. So before you start delete, so because you don't want to actually move all of the things, because that's just not how typically half of the stuff is not even used. So you really want to focus on those things which are used. Put everything in the right place, the rule of 3, the permission mantra, and minor governance. So really walking through the different learning from the real-world scenarios. So really cool stuff from Alex on that one. But that's it for that one. So let's actually stop presenting. I will need to go to another meeting in a second, but that's how it works. Today's been a pretty crazy day. Anything cool happening this week on your side?
So we have just gotten a request from somebody on GCC High. And for those who don't know, like on Azure, it's cloud. But there are multiple types of cloud. So there is the public cloud, there is the cloud GCC High, which is for US government,
cloud,
German cloud, China cloud.
Thunder cloud.
Yes, exactly. Cumulonimbus.
Exactly.
Yes. Right. So, and for all these different clouds, while they're still on Microsoft cloud, they use different names for resources, different URLs to authenticate, and so forth and so on. So we got a request, or somebody saw that we don't properly deal in CLI with the US government cloud. So I want to give it a shot. Like, could we implement that? And the challenge there is that you don't get a tenant to play with, to test.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in the dark, and the only thing you can get is if you know somebody who is on it, to have that person test it for you.
Now you have probably heard that Beethoven made his last symphonies when he was still deaf. So you don't need
it's
to have access to something.
It's shot.
A simulation.
It's a
exactly.
50 shot. It might work, might not work. It's the same
exactly.
For him. I don't know.
Yeah. And if he can make it, why can't you make it? So
well, I wouldn't necessarily compare myself to him, but...
Cool. I have no idea what's happening this week on my side. I've been having a really hectic Monday, so it's jumping from different topics to different topics and presentations and all of that. So I need to figure out tomorrow morning what's going to happen this week.
So that was exactly the same thing for me until I came to the point that like I need to organize myself. I need to better understand what I'm doing. So then I created a mind map of, okay, what are different things that I have on my plate? And then, okay, what are things that are blocked because I'm waiting for somebody versus what are the things that I can do? And that allows me to not drop any balls. So
yep.
Do this because I'm waiting. And they're like every day just like reshuffle. Okay, is this still on? Is this still up to date or not?
Yep.
Because otherwise, it's exactly as you say. Like, and that's also, I think, typical for our jobs, I can say, is that I'm not doing one thing. I'm working on 10 things in parallel, and every day I'm pushing them a little bit.
Yeah, that's true as well.
Getting things done eventually, not
definitely
not every day.
But then the downside of that one is that you might have days when you're like, I didn't get anything done today, which is like, they pushed things forward. So it's exactly. absolutely fine.
So it's all perception about like how do you determine the value of your day. And in our job, it's not getting things done always.
That's true. That is true. But now let's actually close this one. So thank you, everybody, for watching. Thank you, everybody, for listening and watching, depending on what format you're using. We'll be back within the within a week. So, yeah, it's a weekly show. So. But have a great week, and we'll be in touch. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.